This time of year, you're going to find me jigging for crappies off my father-in-law's boat, celebrating a successful turkey hunt, or just sitting on the back deck watching time go by with a quality cigar from Thompson Cigar. Thompson Cigar has been around since 1915, offering the widest array of cigars and cigar accessories at very affordable prices. Thompson Cigar offers your favorite brands like Swisher Sweets, Cohiba, Backwoods, and Monte Cristo shipped fresh directly to your door. Also, be sure to check out their 5-pack fever deals and join their value club for big savings. Visit thompsoncigar.com and enter the discount code SE at checkout for 20% off of all orders over $75. Thompson Cigar, quality cigars at affordable prices.
You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, brought to you by Full Sneak Gear. Check out their entire lineup at fullsneakgear.com. Also, be sure to check out our entire stable of podcasts at sportsmansempire.com. This episode of the Sportsman's Empire is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. Since 1952, Interstate Batteries has been evoking compassion and a trustworthy spirit into the surrounding communities. Interstate Batteries is a mission-driven company fueled by purpose and guided by their values. If you need help locating a specific battery, stop into your local Interstate Batteries retail store and speak with a battery specialist. They even offer cell phone repairs. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.
Two Good & Co. coffee creamers are made with farm-fresh cream, real milk, and contain 3 grams of sugar per serving. That's 40% less than the 5 grams per serving in leading traditional coffee creamers for a rich, delicious experience. Whether you enjoy your coffee hot, cold, bold, or frothy, Two Good coffee creamers make every sip a good one. Two Good coffee creamers, real goodness in every sip. Find them at your local Kroger in the creamer aisle.
Where's your playlist taking you? Down the highway? To the mountains? Or just into daydream mode while you're stuck in traffic? With over 4,000 hotels worldwide, Best Western is there to help you make the most of your getaway. Wherever that is. Because the only thing better than a great playlist is a great trip. Life's the trip. Make the most of it at Best Western. Book direct and save at bestwestern.com.
President's Day savings are happening now at the Home Depot with up to 40% off select appliances. Looking to upgrade your fridge? Check out LG's newest model, serving up ice in all kinds of styles. Cube, crushed, craft ice, and now new mini craft ice straight from the dispenser. From cold brew to fizzy favorites, these refrigerators will have you entertaining like a pro. Shop President's Day savings and get up to 40% off, plus free delivery on select appliances like LG at the Home Depot. Free delivery on appliance purchases of $1,498 or more. Offer valid February 5th through the 25th, U.S. only. See store online for details.
Welcome to Maximize Your Hunt, the podcast dedicated to those who want the most out of their hunting property. This podcast explores land management, habitat improvement, and hunting strategies that will help you maximize your time in the field. Follow along as industry professionals that live and breathe white-tailed deer share their secrets to success. And now, the founder of Whitetail Landscapes, your host, John Teeter.
Hi, I'm John Teeter, Whitetail Landscapes. This is Maximize Your Hunt. Welcome back, everybody. Hopefully everybody's doing well. I just got back from a client visit this morning. I stopped down and I had a client bring some amendments back from his location. I'm very fortunate. There's this whole collaboration concept of community that's around me, and I've said this a lot of times. Sandro, I appreciate you, and I appreciate your willingness to support me in my business. You know, a lot of opportunities that have come about in my life have been recently because of clients, which has been great for me. Being able to get some natural amendments on the landscape, there's only one location I can get some of these certain amendments at. So as everyone knows, I have the 18 acres of hell that I'm trying to work through. And part of that's converting some of that thicket area, which was buckthorn, into a more, we'll just say, regenerative type landscape. So that starts with amending the soil. One thing I want to mention is once I fix the soil, and I just want to quickly just address this really quick. On average, on most properties, what I can tell you right now, if you're going to go from a field conversion, or excuse me, a wooded setting or a you know, thicket setting, shrubland setting to a field setting. Once you're in the field setting, your amendments are going to cost you anywhere between, I would say, $300 to $3,000 an acre. And that's pretty much the range of things. It seems like an extreme spread, and it is. But it's important for you to address that when you make your plan, because if you just clear out or create an open area on the landscape and you're not thinking about amending it, and there's many ways to amend those areas, these amendments that I'm going to apply will last me anywhere between 8 to 15 years. My total investment is going to be right around about $1,200, roughly, per acre. That's my, you know, that's that one anchor food plot within that particular area. So you can kind of do the math on that. It's my methodology. It's how I do, you know, my food plot system. It's a little unique. But once I create those food plots and I get the collaboration between the plants and I make sure it's resource rich, there's abundant nutrients available to the plants, it's not devoid of any biology. You know, some of the systems I put in place, and I've got some new opportunities to try, thank you again through this podcast, new biological amendments that I'm going to be applying in the landscape. And so it's creating this communication amongst plants in these natural communities. And then as a result of that, usually the plants in those areas thrive and therefore the deer have high interest. That's a simple equation to success in food plotting. That's it. It shouldn't be any more complicated than that. And I don't want to say I'm an anti-herbicide guy. I do use herbicide, but I use it at such a limited rate that I'm in a mode of fighting plants with plants and introducing very limited use of any type of herbicide in the landscape whatsoever. So I think you just need to be more conscious and have a system down that makes sense to you. Some things take more time. I've been doing a lot of work by hand recently because I haven't been able to get equipment in an area. And so what that's made me do is to be more, you know, strong-minded and willed in getting certain things done and making sure, hey, this is going to take me five times longer now because I have to do certain things by hand. And so it's just making sure you're conscious of the effort that you need to apply to your property and not overexerting yourself, have balance in your life. And so I just want to kind of start that before we get into the podcast. I've got a brand new guest on, and this guest, I think, is going to be an interesting conversation. We've not had a beekeeper or anybody interested in bees on this podcast. I don't recall us having anybody. So I'm interested in learning more about bees and the landscape and their benefit. And this kind of just builds into this whole food systems, being a part of food systems and your landscape, making sure that you're not controlling the landscape completely and integrating yourself in a way where there's coherence. I like to use that word more frequently than not, and building these complex landscapes. So let me get the guest on the line. Bill, are you there?
I am. Thanks, John.
Hey, man. Sorry, I had a little monologue here, and I was just kind of going off. I had some time to reflect in the car back from that client visit this morning, and I've just been thinking about a bunch of things on the ride, so I just had to get them off my chest. How you been?
Good. Excellent, really.
Good. So you're a Central New York guy, and I love that. We're both local. I have not met you before. Yep. I had talked to you a couple weeks ago, and I asked you, hey, listen to some of these podcasts. I think you're a good fit. Your personality works well. And for my audience, and I think we just have a great conversation kind of about how you view the landscape, any nuances or things specific that you kind of do with your business, and then most importantly, how we can be better stewards of our land and think about bees on the landscape. That's kind of my goal here.
Yeah, just as you were talking there, I was thinking, you know, we do line up quite a bit as trying to keep things, you know, full compass and diversity in that. And a lot of beekeepers will take all the honey away and say, well, this honey's no good for them for surviving. We're just going to give them sugar water. Like, you know, that's just plain and it doesn't really provide anything but sugar. Whereas the honey is just like, it's got a diverse amount of nutrients and other things in it. Every flower produces a different food for the bees, and they have a lot of mix that goes into it. It gets in the fall, it gets to be a very dark honey. Beekeepers say like, no, let's get rid of that dark honey because it causes dysentery, which is diarrhea, and makes the bees sick. So, well, if naturally bees produce a darker honey in the fall and they're getting ready for winter, you think they know better than us. So, and I think that's the same thing. We try to change things in our environment to, you know, how we think it should be without reading what is actually happening in the environment and letting it be more natural. I think that's where we line up.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, excellent point. Right off the bat. So let's hear a little bit about you, and let's talk a little bit about your business and your philosophies around, you know, beekeeping and managing bees in their natural settings. And then I really want to get to the end of this, just a topic so we don't forget is, you know, what can we do as stewards of our landscape to support bee populations and just be more conscious of that? So I want you to run with this.
Yeah, well, I mean, I've listened to a couple of your podcasts now, and you've said it many different times, and that word is key, diversity. We definitely need a large amount of different things that can, you know, it's not just honeybees. Honeybees are what I do, but as far as pollinators and producing a landscape that like will flourish, honeybees aren't going to do it. Honeybees are good at collecting from a single source flower. So if one type of flower, like if one tree is in bloom, they're going to go to that tree and they're going to ignore everything else because, well, that tree is producing greater nectar and a greater pollen source for the bees. So they're just going to ignore everything else that's in bloom and they're going to, you know, they're going to not flourish as well and they're not going to be pollinated. We need to have other bees, carpenter bees, bumblebees, sweat bees, mason bees, all these other type of bees that are pollinators, including butterflies and bats and several other things that do that. So it's really trying to provide an environment for all the bees. And when we see these memes out there that say, save the bee, and we're going to be hearing real soon about how devastating the winter of 24-25 was to the honeybee population. If you haven't already heard it, it's all the other bees.
Yeah. So it's not just bees. And to your point, it's wasps, beetles, butterflies, moths. I mean, there's all sorts of animals and insects that are propagating and pollinating and, you know, moving different resources in and around on the landscape. And that whole control piece of it that you mentioned is what's been, we think everything is disease ridden. So if, and that's probably a bad term, but you're looking at things from a manner of, if it doesn't benefit me or I can't see the purpose in it, it doesn't need to exist. And there's been a lot of, there's been that mindset that I think has started to plague. I'm certain many people, and at times even myself, and I've had to kind of work through why I would have these preconceived ideas that are absolutely incorrect. So I let nature sometimes rewild itself, but in that sometimes I'm controlling what's existing on the landscape. You know, I find myself doing that more often than not because I have an end goal of trying to attract, you know, bucks or does or, you know, just deer on the landscape. They're attracting in these particular areas. And I'm like, well, why is everything so deer centric? It's just, it's a myopic view. So I just want to add to the conversation.
Right.
I mean, because this is a deer centric podcast and it's so much bigger than that. So I got an email the other day and I don't have the email in front of me, but the listener asked me, they're like, you know, I want to hear more about bees. And I'll just tell you a quick story of myself. So the property that I purchased, I own 46 acres here in Tully, New York. The gentleman that had hunted it for many, many years was a beekeeper, and he kept bees on the property. That was another benefit. He was able to do that there. Well, I wanted him to stay. I wanted him to stay on the property, keep the bees. You know, I just saw some value in everything that I was doing. And it wasn't my first experience with bees, but it was my first experience kind of working, you know, with another individual on the landscape that was in the same mindset of me. He ended up being a client of mine, and I worked on one of his properties. But it was just, it seemed like so beneficial. And I noticed, you know, there was so much activity around that beehive, whether it's deer interest, just pollination opportunities. And then unfortunately, he, on his new property, moved all his hives. And of course, you know, he's benefiting from it. But I really kind of enjoyed that time. And I still have some hives here around my house. But it's another thing that I just really haven't had the time to get into. So, you know, I have a pretty basic understanding of the benefits, but beyond that, like actually beekeeping itself. And then, you know, like I want to get into is on the landscape and thinking about bees, where they exist, why they exist in certain locations. Maybe you can kind of just dive into that.
Well, there's looking at honeybees can exist. They need to have a cavity to live in. So you need dead trees, or maybe even a live tree with, you know, that's hollowing out in the middle. And a lot of people take those down thinking, well, that's no good. We got to have a good solid live tree, or, you know, what they're called, snags, the snag tree, which is just a dead rotted tree with tons of holes in it. But it has more life in one of those than it does a live tree. You go fully healthy, you know, that just has bark and leaves, you know, and that a tree like that will harbor, you know, like you said, beetles and mason bees and such other things. So I think it's important not just to have, you know, tend to the life, but see life in trees and other things that don't look alive to us, but they, you know, if you look into them and take them apart, they really are.
If you go down the road of trying to create these environments for bees specifically, and you have to do a lot of removal, right? Because people see them as a nuisance. How does that kind of work in your world? I think on your website, you talked about rewilding the bee or moving it to other areas. How does that work?
Well, my specialty, I guess, is removing colonies of bees that are embedded in structures, such as bedroom walls and other parts of people's homes or barns or what have you around their areas where, you know, they're getting into a house and, you know, they do become a nuisance if they're getting into your house. But I always try to counsel my customers on that. Like if they're not getting into your house, if they're high up in the side of your house where they're not bothering anybody on the ground, to have a live colony of honeybees is actually a benefit for the house. They'll come in and they'll stabilize the wood rot. They'll keep anything else from getting in, any other pests, and almost be like a guard system to keeping the house healthier. Hmm. Whereas if you take the bees out, you're going to pay me a bunch of money and you're going to leave your house open to other things, which you're going to have to, you know, spend more money on to maintain. So if you got a good, healthy colony, I don't mind people keeping them there. And wasps, on the other hand, they make a mess of things. Yeah. So they'll start using your walls as part of their nest and they come in. So, but as far as honeybees go, you know, I try to say, I'm just waiting for that one customer to say, yeah, I think I'd like you to put a window in so I can watch the bees in my wall rather than take them out. So.
Oh my gosh. I love that. What a different perspective. So let's say you're able to, you're working with the client and they want you to remove the bees, and obviously you're identifying the bees and their particular domain where they're living and why. How do you rewild them? What's the process? Or do you, you know, just kind of walk us through that?
Rewilding? Well, it's not really that. Sometimes.
Bad term, right?
Well, what ends up happening is they go in a regular beehive in my backyard and I monitor them for a while. And hopefully they'll make honey for me. Sometimes they get there and they say, well, this box sucks. I'm out of here. And the whole colony will just leave and go find someplace else. And I got a lot of woods and swamp in my area, so they've got places to go. And then other times I've got, I work with tree guys, and when they have to take a tree down and that has a beehive in it, well, I'll go take that section of tree, which is usually about a 6-foot section, hopefully not too big of a diameter so I can handle it. But I've got a lot of tree trunks in my yard that if they don't have bees in it or if the colony dies for some reason, I'll actually go in there. And when I bring a colony of bees home, I'll introduce them back into the trunk of the tree so they can live in their natural environment versus a thin pine box.
Is there competition in these areas because you have such smaller spaces? So you're conglomerating bees in a particular area and I'm assuming they travel a fair distance, but is there any worry of that, you know, in your particular setting?
People say that with more honeybees in an area, they take the resources of, you know, of the wild bees and the other bugs in the area, but I really haven't seen that. I see if it's just a good, healthy year, a productive year, and this year isn't really shaping up too well with all this rain, but, probably get a lot of mosquitoes. Bees don't take any resources from mosquitoes, but a good healthy year is I get a lot of bees. My bees are healthy, and you know, you go out into the field and I brush hog it once a year, so it it comes, you know, it's beautiful wildflower fields, and the diversity in them is amazing. It's just everything's out there.
I've kind of wondered, you know, if an individual wanted to get into this from you know, making a relationship. I know that there's, I think there's different groups, and you can tie in with some of the groups that offer. I'm not just talking about equipment, but, you know, having somebody on your property that is a caretaker, or you yourself being a caretaker of bees, like those relationships seem, you know, mutually beneficial, especially knowing somebody like you, where these hives can be placed in key locations and, again, benefit on the landscape. I guess from a bigger picture standpoint, thinking about just pollination of wild plants, as well as just kind of like maintaining like hive structure and all that kind of stuff. And you were using like natural snags or, you know, dead wood that you were cutting out. I mean, I think that's really cool. We also have ground nesting bees as well. And those are important to think about, I'm sure. So how do you look at like a layout where you're going to have somebody put bees on the landscape? It's got to be accessible. Maybe you're mowing in and around those areas. I mean, we have bear issues in some with some clients. I mean, maybe talk around some of those topics. I'm not sure how often you deal with bears in our area, but just in general.
Well, thankfully, I haven't seen them in my area at all, and hopefully, I won't. Their travel area is they tend to travel along paths that are not near me, so a few miles over, pretty close, but I don't think they'll be this way, so I don't have to deal with it. But other people that deal with it have to put up electric fences to keep them away, because they do. They see a beehive, and they'll destroy it. They'll take it apart and eat all the larvae out of it and some of the honey, and just break stuff. It's no good. As far as you know, mowing around things, well, in the natural, in the wild, bees tend to choose locations that are 20 to 30 feet in the air. So that eliminates bears right there. And a lot of other things like raccoons and skunks. Skunks love pollen or love wasps and bees. They will go in there at night and just start tapping the hive and eating the bees as they come out. Same thing with ground nesters. They'll go in there and dig up the hives, usually in the fall after they've done their job. But they'll find them and pull them up. So I think we talked earlier about, I think I mentioned people make boxes for owls, for birds, you know, other birds. And, you know, you can, depending on the type of box, the size of the box, the location of the box, the hole in the box, you can attract a specific type of bird to nest in that box. Same thing with honeybees. You can make a honeybee box that they'll enjoy and they'll move into, and you can put it up, you know, 20, 30 feet in the air, and you'll have honeybees on your property without, you know, having to worry about maintaining it or protecting it from anything else. They'll be in, you know, you'll have bees in there for 2 or 3 years, and then you'll have a season without them. And it goes through a recycling process. They'll get other things in there. They'd eat the wax and clean out the box. And then the next year, the bees will be right back there.
Would you explain like what a honeybee box looks like, and are there natural ways to create them? And, you know, can we use some material in the landscape to do that?
Well, other than using a old tree with a hole in it, bee box is basically about 5 gallons in volume, and it has an 1.5-inch hole in it. That's about it.
Okay.
Yeah. So I've made them with OSB, and they've lasted years and years hung up in a tree. And I've watched them come and go. I put a piece of 1/2-inch hardware cloth on the front. That way it keeps mice out of there and bats and birds. But other than that, they'll live in there just fine.
What about the bee houses that I've seen? They almost have like a tubular component to them, and they're basically hollowed out stems that they double stack, triple stack. And, you know, they make these, yep, kind of, what are those for?
Those are specifically for mason bees and other bees, kind of like leaf cutter bees, which are the same thing. They basically, they live in the spring for a few weeks. They'll come in, they'll lay an egg, bring in some food and pack it full of mud to seal it up. And then after a couple of weeks of doing that, the adults die and those eggs will sit there all summer long, all winter long, and then they will hatch in the next spring and they'll come out. And they're supposed to be replaced every year. because they can harbor diseases that, you know, accumulate over the years that make it worse for the mason bees to live in. So, you know, we talk, it's the whole save the bee idea. Let's put a bee house in our yard, but they don't talk about how it needs to be replaced and how, what they're for and why. There's other things you can do, like bumblebees. Bumblebees are kind of a ground nester. They like old rodent tunnels and burrows and things. You just put a clay pot out there with a little entrance into it, and they'll build under a clay pot or a cinder block even. They just need a little space that's protected.
So would it be more appropriate in we'll just go back to the mason bee thing, because, again, I see a lot of those on the landscape where people are, you know, again, trying to save the bee. Just having more hollow stem plants across the landscape that are being kind of managed in a format. Like, I could just picture, like, a lot of these hollow stem plants that you're going through and you're kind of cutting the top, you know, out of the leaflet or the you know, the top of the stem, and now these hollow tubes are available to a whole host of resident bees, and then they have these homes, and then you go through a cycle of, you know, you're not cutting those out over time, but eventually you're getting more plant development. I mean, it seems like more of a natural way to kind of remedy the bee box.
Oh, 100%.
Okay.
100% for that, for the mason bees. Yeah. And other small bees like that. Okay. Is having to have those reeds or whatever they are that do have those, you know, grasses that have those hollow tubes in them, because they're going to grow up. They're going to, you know, they're going to break and fall over, and the bees will find the places to build. And then the snow will beat it into the ground. And the next year you're going to have fresh. You don't have to go out and do it yourself.
And I'm picturing these environments, and this is kind of gets me in my feels. I'm picturing these environments where you've got these old fields managed with kind of some of the plants that we're identifying there. And then we, you know, the hollow stem plants, and then we have some redbud, service berry, wild cherry, apples, you know, crab apples, pears, plums, willows, just these environments for these early spring pollinators that are adjacent to their, you know, nesting sites or resident homes. And it's just the synergy between the two environments where you've got kind of the ground or mid-story level trees and just this combination of design and coherence of areas. And then you mentioned the ground nesters. And so I'm thinking about the ground nesters, and I go to hedgerows for some reason, because when I was a kid, did a lot of woodchuck hunting, and those areas were a great resident location for woodchucks. Well, it was also a great resident location for bees, and you'd bump into a bee or two in those particular areas when you're laying up against a hedgerow trying to whack a woodchuck when it comes out of its, you know, its hole. So maybe there's something there with kind of, you know, hedgerows and plants in around hedgerows, and just thinking out loud.
Yeah, it makes sense. I mean, it's that diversity. You don't want to just have the plants that you want. You want to have the animals that create those other areas. That in a house, when I'm removing a colony, I can almost predict I will find three things in there. One, the mice have been in there first. They've come in and they've made a space. They've taken the insulation out of a wall and made that space. Next, I'm going to find like a mud wasp. So you like a chunk of mud with tubulars in it that where they have raised their young. And then I will also find a paper wasp, you know, those big, great big basketball size paper nests that you see hanging from trees are usually in one of the walls too. And, or at least the remnants of it. So those come in first, and then we get honeybees afterwards. So it's the same thing with like bumblebees. They need a place to live. You're going to get a mole or a rat or something else that's, you know, tunneling in the ground that is now abandoned, and the bumblebees can come in and live. Or, you know, like you said, woodchucks. So you got to invite all these things in to eventually have more of that diversity of what you want to live there.
So there's another piece of this that I'm kind of wondering about, and I've seen this in my own personal yard, bare ground, and having, you know, bare ground space for them to able to burrow. Now, I don't know what type of bees typically burrow, and I feel like it's ground wasps, but are certain bees burrowing, and do they need bare ground? Is that a a requirement?
A sandy ground, yes. There is a type of ground bee, and it's an individual type bee. Same thing with mason bees. They're a very small gentile bee, and a sandy soil that's not too wet, that they can move and still hold structure when they build their tunnels. And those things come up in the spring also. They're awesome pollinators, along with the mason bees. And I always recommend them to, give areas for them to survive in when people have apple orchards and other fruit trees that bloom in the spring, because that's when they're active.
Well, here's the other thing. We talked about mowing, or you mentioned mowing for a second. And I think I might have led that as another example of trying to manage a landscape. I mean, I do some mowing every now and again in certain areas, and try to rotate my mowing strips, where I mow, why I mow, et cetera. Mowing can be a resource. It can be a benefit, and it can be a negative. And, we're taking away vegetation in some cases, and that may be a problem, on the landscape. The other piece of it is, grass or grasslands, and we have very few of them in our particular areas just because of our region, but like those grassland landscapes tend to be dominated by, non-native grasses or just grasses in general. How do bees and grasses interrelate? Because we always think about flowers and flowering plants and creating these pollinator mixes with just a lush array of flowers, and there's a very little component of grass, but I feel like grass is needed for some form of structure. We were talking about earlier, like, hollow tubes and for things to kind of reside. What's your opinion on just mowing? I mean, is it a negative? Is it a positive? Do we need to mow? If we're going to go to the, what we've deemed as traditional of having these boxes on the landscape and mowing around those areas, is that a necessity? I'm just interested. Probably for work it is.
Yeah. As far as mowing around my beehives, I don't want tall grass because, that's where the ticks like to hide out, and that's where other things. It's annoying to be able to work through them, and then the bees get lost in the grass when I'm taking the hives apart. And so, I want to mow for my convenience in that. Also, tall grass will make the beehives rot more, so we don't want that either. But as far as my fields around on my land, I like to mow usually in the fall after everything's gone to seed, so it kind of, knocks everything back and doesn't allow trees to come up, so it remains a field. Otherwise, everything will slowly creep in, and it already is quite a bit. But, the edges, the hedgerows start to creep in across the grass, and the trees kind of lean over and try to take over. And so it's an effort to keep it a field. But I think it's a necessary part in my area, not just, because my bees are going to fly out. They're going to go up to 5 miles away, and that's 80 square miles they cover.
Wow.
So I can't control all that. But just to have that field in my area, I'd love to walk out through it and see all the things moving through it. I end up with a lot of mice in the field, which brings in hawks and snakes and other neat things to see out there, along with all the other insects. And just being a beekeeper, I was never interested in this stuff before, but now every place I go, I start looking at the fields and the flowers and the ditches and what trees are growing and just see the landscapes people put in their own front yards. And I see how, you mentioned it before, it's like, if it doesn't suit our needs or what we think is beautiful, it just doesn't need to exist. And a lot of people do that, but it can see the work and effort that's required to make those things not exist, because they will come back if left alone. And I find interesting houses that have come down and have been abandoned, and how just nature takes them back over and puts all those things back there that were once people didn't want because it didn't suit their needs. So I try to encourage what nature has already put there, so that it brings in all that diversity and supports the ecosystem in that sense.
I've wondered this specifically, and we kind of hit on this, so I want to just get back to it. Is they're using bees for, because they're saying, you know, bees on landscape are starting to diminish, and maybe we need to get into maybe some of the thoughts around that. But, you know, we're introducing non-localized bees, and you mentioned the fact that, and maybe this is your viewpoint, is if you have a hive, or we've talked about having snags and hoping that bees eventually go to those locations, if they're in collaboration, not competition, and this is part of this other process, is, you know, as humans, there is some element of control that we're adding when we add or we promote new things on the landscape, right? And we think, you know, they may be a benefit. In your mindset, you know, having more bees is a good thing, period, right? I mean, is there anything that's negative about having maybe bees that are resident to this area in these areas? And we talked a second ago about displacing, you know, the natural bees, but it seems like some of these bees are really specific. They have a specific purpose. They're intended to do this, at least the way we look at it. Is there something I'm missing in this equation that would make introducing bees that aren't resident or non-native, we'll just say, just use that term, is there a negative or something that I'm missing? I've read some studies about this over the years, and I can't remember all the details. I just remember that they tend to use a lot of the same plants that our natural bees that are here on the landscape use, and if they're already diminishing in, you know, in what we would say would be a normal, maybe there's a cycle to this, and we don't fully understand that as human beings. What are your thoughts on anything I just mentioned?
I don't know.
Yeah. I'm tending to get off this path of being a complete naturalist with everything, and I'm realizing that as humans we can add our perspective into things, and my perspective has been, if there's something declining and we're doing something that is creating negativity, and there's a foundational issue, whether it's herbicides, how we're managing the landscape, you know, and some of it's just process of change. Things change in the landscape naturally, whether, you know, we promote different plants or just the climate is shifting, or, you know, plants are shifting in the landscape. Everything's moving all the time. My opinion is,
right.
You know, my opinion is I perceive it as a benefit, regardless of the idea that there's displacement, and that displacement's so small at this point, any benefit to the species, plant species specifically in the landscape, the propagation of those, assuming they're plants that we hope continue to propagate and they're beneficial to everything else, is a positive. And I also don't think that just because a plant produces a nut or produces a fruit means that it's everything to us. We look at it, what does it do for us, not what it does for the environment. And there's many plants that are on the landscape that aren't intended to produce, you know, a fruit that we consume or a nut that we consume. And therefore, we need to think that every plant has purpose and every plant matters. If that sounds probably kind of cliche, but you see how I'm getting at?
I think so. I think you opened up with something about adding amendments to the soil. And I assume you mean fertilizer, basically.
Well, a fertilizer, in the term I use it, is energy. So anything that adds energy to landscape. And so if it's zinc or copper, right, anything that's,
right.
And they're mining from a mine that has zinc, mining from an area that has copper. So I'm just adding what lacks in our geology. So to me,
right.
It's the same thing, right?
So in that aspect, plants grow and use that stuff up, right?
Yep.
And then there's other plants that grow and use other stuff up and actually amend the soil backwards, so those other plants that use the stuff up first will have more of that so they can grow again. And when we look around, a lot of things we hear is invasive species, right? An invasive species typically is something that is doing very well in the soil that's there and in the landscape that's available, and it's kind of crowding out other things. Now, I think that's a negative term. However, if they're coming in because they're doing well, it's because the other plants are losing nutrients that they require. And I think my prediction would be, is if you look at invasive species and what they're adding to the ground, it's what those plants that they're currently taking over need to survive. So once they use up everything that they have, because every plant uses something a little bit different in the soil. And then we have different, you know, root depths. You said something about grasses earlier. Grasses are required because they have a deep root system and it holds the ground together so that the shorter root systems won't just blow away or wash away, such as, you know, in flowers and different things.
I love this conversation. I'm gonna add to what you're saying. So you bring up like this awesome point. So I'm removing buckthorn on my property. And when you remove buckthorn, and buckthorn is pretty easy to get out of the ground, which is awesome. But I looked at it as healing the ground. And this is totally opposite. You know, anybody who probably listens to this podcast is like, what is this guy talking about? So the buckthorn thickets have a tendency to produce a ton of carbon, and they're really nitrogen rich soils. I mean, the ground is black can be. And I am fortunate, and I wouldn't say this publicly because it's something that people don't necessarily, you know, observe all the time. But when I go in a thicket and it's previous buckthorn, the natural concern is, oh my God, this is going to take me forever to remove it. Well, the benefit is my soils are super enriched. And really interesting concept that you brought up, because I'm getting more in touch with those things. And then I'm looking at, you know, what are the chemical deficiencies within that profile of soil and what will eventually rebound or work well in those conditions, just kind of based on the overall kind of ecoregion. And then it's my job to kind of influence that well enough where I'm adding little pieces at a time and I'm not removing everything on the landscape, because that was persisting for a reason. And I don't want to denude an area that is already, I feel like, is enriched by a plant. And if that plant doesn't, I guess, serve a purpose that I see it, I need to really think about that, you know, from my perspective to see what its ecological benefits are before I just decide to start cutting it or frilling it and adding herbicide to kill it. It seems a little bit, you know, eco-terrorist-like when you come in and you start taking over and making decisions, because do I really know best? And those are the things that I've been starting to ask myself before I make these next steps. And this is the real kind of mental healing journey that I've been going through, is being like, hey, I got to be more mindful of this stuff. You know, it doesn't have to be this wild plum thicket with crab apples and eastern redbud and, you know, red maple scattered thereabouts. Like those things will persist if they choose to persist. And I've kind of let some things, and I used this term earlier, rewilding, probably in your circumstance, it doesn't make any sense, but allowing nature to kind of replenish itself in its own way, if that makes sense. But then doing some things in a small scale to meet the needs that I think are appropriate for my goals. So it's, I'm kind of weighing that counterpoint, if that makes sense.
That does make sense. Yeah, that's exactly how I think about it, is that, of course, we want stuff that we want. But if we completely eliminate the stuff that the ground wants or the area needs to be successful, well, we're just making it harder on ourselves. And I think the ultimate goal would be to make things easier for ourselves, right?
Yeah.
And be able to just go out there and say, wow, this is exactly how it needs to be without too much of my help. We just go out there and you know, make our area that we want to walk through and be in how we like it. You know, just like my fields. I don't want a full forest in my backyard. I'd like to have a nice meadow, a nice field out there. So I encourage that field by mowing and not let the forest take over.
What do you think are killing the native bees, or bees for that matter, across the landscape? What do you think the big picture issues are that, and I know this is a really loaded question, but what are you seeing? Is it humans in general? Is it their bad practices? Is it herbicides? What's changing the landscape?
I think so. I know in my area, they spray for mosquitoes, right? The mosquito spray is something that works in the water. When it gets into the water system, it also gets into the fish. And then it just goes on from there, and then the water obviously feeds everything else. But the salt they put on the roads in our areas, and the, you know, stop the, I mean, we've had, for the last decade, we've had amazingly dry roads and non-icy roads throughout winter. Well, that's because of so much chemicals are putting on the roads. And where does that go? I watched, I grew up on Oneida Lake, and when they switched from dirt to salt, it killed every oak tree on the street. I mean, from just around the whole town where the oak trees grew, they can't handle that salt, and the landscape changed. People who put fertilizers in their lawn, that changed the lake. It added fertilizer to the lake, which made the seaweed and everything in the lake, the plants in the lake grow up greater and cause congestion on top. And, you know, then that comes up and rots and causes a stink. And it just, we think we're doing good for people by keeping the roads clear, which, yeah, of course it helps keep people safe. Of course, if roads are slippery, people are going to drive safer too. But, and then, you know, putting fertilizer on our lawn to make it green, you know, that old weed and feed that kills certain things and makes other things grow better. Okay, sure, we got a nice green lawn now, but of course that doesn't do any good for pollinators because it's now a food desert. They don't have anything there for them. So there's all those give and takes that I think we, our eye sees one thing of beauty, but we don't see the loss of life in it. Same thing with my big pet peeve is monocrops and industrial agriculture, where these vegetarians would say, hey, eat vegetables. But they don't see these farms that are killing all the little critters that live in the ground, all the bugs and, you know, moles and snakes and snails and all this stuff that typically lives are being killed by these farmers. So, you know, vegetarians, you know, are blind to that. And biodiverse is a new term that I heard about farm. It's beyond organic. So you use different animals in a farming situation to do what you're doing in a landscape. You know, one thing feeds another that helps boost and grow the soil and grow the landscape versus take it down and destroy things just to grow one thing. To have a diversity is so important.
This is a complicated situation where there are a combination of many things that are resulting in change. And bees provide kind of ecological resilience. That's the way I look at bees and any type of insect, really. And some are more parasitic, even the ones that are disease ridden, they get taken over. Like there's just the system of life, right? The strong will survive. But in these environments, and same thing with food plots, in my food plot designs, I have these really complete, not competitive, but complementary plants that are work synergistically. And so once I balance the soil and I add these plants, I don't get plants that I don't prefer in there. And it's really interesting where an area on my own property, I'm taking this a different direction, but it just makes me think about two things. I was on a client this past week and they were spraying insecticide all over their apple trees. And I asked them, I said, is that like, does that seem sensible? You know, does that really seem sensible? You're just denuding the landscape of all these insects. And we're thinking about these bee populations, how they're impacted by insecticides, because they persist in those environments within the soil for years and years and years. And we can't really even gauge their impact. And obviously that's in the plant and the pollen. And so these food plot systems, like one example, I use bone meal. Okay, so it's ground up bone, okay, that I'm spreading in the landscape. It has a high level of phosphorus because we lack phosphorus. We have high potassium here because all our energy was basically leached out of the system eons ago, and potassium is pretty much the predominant component of a large proportion of our soil, and everything else is denuded that have been anions that have been depleted of the soil. Those are some of the health components. That's why I'm focused on zinc and copper. And so, you know, putting small amendments and small amounts on the landscape are revitalizing these particular areas, and you're not getting these unwanted plants in the particular landscapes. You can almost control what plants develop. And I have two side-by-side food plots, that one I didn't amend and then one I did amend. One has all the plants that I want in it, and one has a whole host of plants that I never planted in there. And the plants themselves are fixing the soil. Because
exactly, and
it's just this interesting thing that I think people have kind of not even recognized whatsoever. And I'm not a genius that came up with this. I just said I need to balance the soil chemically. I need to have the right variation of plants, and I don't have competition, and they're working together, and I have coherence. And now I'm not adding amendments for 15 years, or my goal is 20 years, and I'm balanced. I'm balancing, and like you mentioned earlier, you know, some plants are intended to persist greater because they are fixing the soil and they are providing a nutrient that may be lacking. And so I'm going a little bit off topic, but I think it's really, really important to think about these things. I want to take you down another road, and this is, we're kind of getting at the end of this, is all insects matter. And that sounds so, again, the term every life matters. I mean, these things are important to our properties, and we want these really kind of coherent, resilient. I want to walk on the property. I want to hear the insects. I want to hear the bees. I want to hear all this stuff. I just want to be immersed in that world. Continuing, if we're trying to maybe avoid some pesticides, insecticides, maybe some folks are planting native wildlife flowers, you know, pollinator type plants. We're managing some of the ground. So there's some bare ground. There's some structure. You mentioned clay pots. We're leaving snag trees. Like, maybe just give us the ideal setting, and then how would we connect with somebody that we would want to have bees, or is that not an option for a lot of people? I know there's a lot of communities around, you know, promoting bees on the landscape. Maybe kind of just give us your perspective on how one would go about creating these nice systems of use and, again, personal benefit, like the honey, et cetera. Just maybe walk us down that road in your mind.
So just in general, to put places for them to live is what we should be, can do, in a yard and a home setting. It's the bushes around the house, you know, the hedgerow that is in our yards is, don't rake it out, you know, don't clean everything up underneath and weed eat around it to make it look pristine. Leave some mess back there. And that mess may be a mess in our eyes, but it's beautiful in the sense of places for animals to live. Same thing if we're trimming trees, well, take all those branches and just put them in a pile and leave them, because things will grow up through them that'll compact and create great cavities for other things to live, including small mammals and insects. I mean, the thought I had earlier that I lost but is now back is, we learned this in kindergarten, right? It's the food chain. The food chain starts with the smallest thing and works up to the biggest thing, you know, it's, you know, supposedly. And it's simply put, I mean, the insects we need to have more insects so we can have more of the bigger things. So it starts out with small, and all those little things that we can have, which live in those small areas, in the piles of brush and in the shrubbery and different things that just pile up, like, you know, make a pile of leaves, make a pile of branches, and just let it sit there, and life will come to it.
Yeah, I think that's simple. I like the one thing you said earlier, Bill, just around, you know, where did the cavities naturally exist? Elevated locations. I mean, it's just being observational on where things are going to exist. Where do you typically find outside of the homes? And I go back to that point earlier. It's like, they need to persist here because these are great environments for them. This is habitat for this particular, you know, insect, because they're displaced otherwise. Maybe there's not as many snag trees, et cetera. On your landscapes, where have you seen, like, a lot of these persistent environments that have been kind of like the epitome of, like, great bee habitat? Maybe just explain that. Like, where have you found certain things that I think people can maybe just take a keener eye on when they're walking their properties?
and the stuff you don't want to walk through, you know, that stuff with the prickers, you know, the thorns and all that scrub brush that is really annoying to get through and grow. And if you cut down a tree and you let some sunlight in, all that stuff grows up. Those are the prime locations for those kind of things. So,
yeah, that's awesome. It reminds me of a quick story from a friend of mine. I have a client who's become a good friend, and we work together from time to time. And he's been on my property multiple times. He's got stung multiple times, got a lot of ground nesting bees through my whole property. We've got debris all over the place just for that specifically. You walk into an area that you're unsuspecting. So it's having a keen eye before you walk into some of those areas. And if you disturb those sites and we were moving brush, you know, we paid the price. And I think I didn't look at it as a negative. I was walking into their home, destroying their home and trying to, I didn't want brush in this particular area. I wanted to move it like 100 yards in another direction. And the net result is, you know, I was attacked.
Right.
And so it's kind of interesting thinking about it in that way. I'm the one that's trying to do something, and I'm the terrorist on the other
side.
Yeah. So.
Yeah, they weren't attacking you. They were defending their home.
Yeah.
They were on the defensive.
Yeah. 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 So. Yeah. I don't know. It's just an interesting perspective. Let me ask you just one last question. If you're trying to connect to somebody in your community where, let's say you don't want to get knee deep into this, you weren't, you know, ready to have hives or something along those lines on your property, but you wanted others to do that. Do people, other than just, you know, people that do this for fun, do you find that people can connect with other people and are able to get more bees on their landscape through communities, even through you? Does that work out some way?
Yeah, there are beekeepers that do lease beehives. And they'll bring hives in, kind of like they lease chicken coops now, you know?
Yep.
And they'll bring it all in for you, and you give them some money, and you get the benefit of watching the bees and getting some honey, and the beekeeper takes care of it all for you. So there's definitely people out there that will lease bees and care for them on your property. And there's other groups, you know, just your local library usually has gatherings and groups that will meet once or a couple times a year that promote things like that. So I'd check with a local library and local beekeepers first.
Yeah, I think it's great. So yeah. I know you're local. We've got listeners all over the country that listen to this, but I think that's good advice to try to connect to people that are local, that are knowledgeable. How'd you get so knowledgeable about this stuff?
Asking questions, and you know, the biggest part is going to places where other people are asking questions, and they're asking questions I never would have thought to ask. And so it's important to let other people ask questions and listen to the answers. It gets the mind going.
What's the biggest question that you're asked that you think the audience should hear and know about this, your profession?
My profession? The question I'm asked every single time is how many times you get stung. So This year I'm up to 186, I think. So it you know, and it's only been going for about 4 weeks now this season. So that's the question. But as far as keeping bees is the other one, is that they'll usually list off everything they've got in their yard, these flowers, these trees, and whatever else. Is that enough to keep bees? And the answer is always yes. Because the bees don't just, you know, aren't just staying within your property borders. They are going out and going much further. You can keep them in the rooftops in New York City, and they can find enough to forage on. There's always a place for bees to be in your land and in your life.
I want to flip the script just one last little thing here, and it's just kind of worth mentioning because we did get in the insecticides and neonics and all the concerns that are surrounding that are across the environment and these kind of polluted environments. Is there a way to, in your mind, because you mentioned plants, to limit or try to control a bad mentality, but to try to reduce their span of movement? Like, can we create more diverse systems? They're in these healthier environments that are more localized. I know this is probably broad scale, but do you think putting in pollinator plantings across the landscape, broad array of different flowers that, you know, that are persistent throughout the season. Is that a sensible thing to do to promote them?
Yeah. They want to be efficient. They're very efficient creatures. And so they'll collect close to home before they fly off. They're not going to skip over what's there to go someplace else. They will collect close to home. And if there's enough there for them to collect without having to go further, well, good on them. They don't have to fly any further, and they're more efficient and they'll stay close to home.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So if you're local to me, and you need support in this area, Bill, how do people get a hold of you? I think that's probably the most easiest way. I know you have a website. What's your website, and what's the easiest way to get a hold of you?
Sure. Yeah, my website is www.itsallbetter.com. And then my Facebook, you can get me on Facebook Messenger, is Facebook.com/BillTheBeekeeper.
Awesome. Well, I appreciate you taking time out of your weekend for me, and super knowledgeable. Your wealth of knowledge, your mindset. I love the mindset. We have very similar kind of mindsets, and I think that kind of gets, it's fortunate for me because it gets me right around the right people and thinking about these things more clearly. And so hopefully with you and everyone else that's working on your personal property, you know, you take some aspects of this discussion and start thinking differently about your property. So thanks for your time, Bill. Appreciate you, and I appreciate your information, and we'll talk again soon.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
All right. See ya.
Maximize Your Hunt is a production of Whitetail Landscapes. For more information on how John Teeter and his team of experts can help you maximize your hunt, check out whitetaillandscapes.com.
You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.